Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Global Britain. We were promised it after Brexit, so how's that working out for us? And does Global Britain mean we have more foreign direct investment into this country, or do we have more British investment in other countries, or is FDI, as it's called by the anachronisters, bad whichever way it goes? Or is it good whichever way it goes? And how does it compare to simply making stuff here and exporting it? Is that what really Global Britain should be about? If so, why is the government talking about FDIs? Even worse, FDIs that see people investing in our share market for companies that might not even be based here. Is there, in fact, any clarity of vision of what exactly we want? That's what we ask today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Well, we learned today that Global Britain has got off to a bad start post-Brexit. Our exports to Europe in January fell by 40.1%, and we can't blame it all on COVID, because exports to non-EU countries actually increased a little bit in January. So all in all, exports fell by over £5 billion in 1 month. It just happens to be the month after we left the EU. I wonder whether Global Britain, the new outlook that comes about because we have broken our ties with Europe, has encouraged by the likes of Steve Keen, I hasten to add. I wonder whether that Global Britain means a Britain owned globally rather than a Britain trading globally. I say that because there's a story in the FT last week that says almost 2 months after Brexit, the value of British businesses sold to overseas buyers is the highest on record for that period, at close to £20 billion in 2 months. This on top of 810 inbound deals in the second half of 2020, which totaled £137 billion. Clearly, UK PLC is up for sale. And the time is right. Remember in 2008 when the pound was worth almost $2, and before Brexit it was even talked about, it was $1.60. Now it's wavering around $1.20 and $1.40. It's at the top end of that right now because of the vaccine rollout. But this low price, Steve, I mean, this is a problem of a weak currency, isn't it? If you are, it makes you liable from corporate takeovers from overseas buyers, and that seems to be exactly what's happening right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is it's also part of the whole mechanics of your total financial flows, because and this is one of the points that MMT gets right in the foundation. I believe they get it wrong when they extend it to the way they talk about international trade. But if you're running a current account deficit, so you are say you're importing and paying other costs equivalent to £20 billion, let's say, a year more than you're getting in, then that's balanced on the capital account, because you've got to sell bonds to that level of value or sell other assets. And overall, whatever your deficit on the current account is what's called a surplus on the capital account. But what that means is you're selling the furniture. You're selling the furniture to cover the cost of food on the table. And the larger your current account deficit is, the bigger that factor is going to be.
But do you have to be selling it, or could you be getting partnerships in, I guess? Because, I mean, there isn't often given as a benefit for foreign direct investment is you've got more money coming into the economy. That creates increased employment, an increase in exports, stronger GDP. Everyone's very happy. But, I mean, that is nonsense, isn't it?
It's a fairy tale.
Developing economies, perhaps that's the case. But it's a nonsense when you're looking at companies buying up UK companies.
Well, it's the usual mistake of thinking everything in terms of physical capital when we're talking about what this international stuff is, monetary capital. Mm. So, you know, there's certainly a link between the physical and the monetary world. But if you take the simplest case of a country running a balance of trade deficit, so it's importing more than it's exporting, then the conventional theory in the world of floating exchange rates was, oh, that'll be taken care of by the exchange rate. The exchange rate will fall your imports will be more expensive. Your exports will earn more in domestic, the same amount international, but that'll be worth more domestically, and it'll all be carried by the exchange rate, the price mechanism, which of course is total fracking bullshit. Did I say fucking there?
I did. You saw it twice in one go, don't worry.
Does that cancel out?
Maybe they do count. If you could put in minus before the second one. I don't know. One of these days you are going to lose our PG rating or even G rating that we've got.
I am. I think I've lost it. It's nonsense. I mean, the whole idea was when we went to floating exchange rates with the breakdown of Bretton Woods back in 71, 73, that was, you know, there's a lot of things to be said in favor of floating exchange rates when you don't have an international currency like the bancor. But when you have them, one of the arguments was, well, the price mechanism will solve everything. Keynes hoped to eliminate or at least minimize balance of trade and balance of payments deficits and surpluses by setting a rule with the bancor that a country running more than a 2% of GDP surplus was forced to spend more to bring its surplus down. And the idea was to keep trade deficits and trade surpluses sort of almost within a sort of bounds of rounding error around zero, with a plus or minus 2%. That was his target. Now, the argument was, well, we couldn't achieve it with fixed exchange rates because with the American dollar being used rather than a global currency like the bancor was supposed to be. But the argument was, don't worry, the price system will hop in here and that'll get rid of the trade surpluses and trade deficits. We'll see countries with the trade surplus have a rapidly appreciating currency and that'll hit them towards zero, and countries with a trade deficit having a depreciating currency, and bang, will come out to pretty much zero.
How does that work in theory, though? So if I've got... what are they trying to say? If I've got a... If my currency is increasing in value, then that is making my imports a lot cheaper. So I'm going to import more. It's going to make my exports more expensive. Mm. Therefore, I'm not going to make as much. I'm just going to import and live off imports. That's the idea. And if it switches the other way, then you'll stop importing and start producing locally. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's the idea. And the fact that there are obvious time lags and that actually...
Exchange rate changes within days or months and it takes generations to set up an industry.
Exactly. And this is what turns up in what was called the J-curve. If you're not quite old enough to remember Paul Keating, are you, back in Australia?
No, of course I am. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't quite sure whether I loved him or hated him, like everybody else.
Well, as for a one-liner, you can't beat him.
Yeah.
But in terms of economics, my theory about Paul Keating was that he wasn't trained in economics. He swallowed an economics textbook and he swallowed a hook, line and sinker and fell for a whole range of mainstream economic thinking. But one particular thing he became quite avid about was talking about what he called the J curve. And this is the idea that you don't get an immediate response to, if your value of your currency plunges by 10%, which can happen very rapidly, that doesn't automatically cause a quantity adjustment of 10% or more in the opposite direction, because as you said, it takes time to do these things. So there was the J curve, and you'd have a trade deficit for a while because you're exporting less than you're importing. Your currency would fall. That would encourage less imports fairly immediately because you're paying a higher price for them straight away. And then over time, you'd develop more export industries because your exports are now cheaper compared to the rest of the world. But that would take time, and then you get a J curve. You'd return back to, you'd go from where you are and down a bit, initially. That's the impact of the bottom, the part of the J going down is where you're suffering from the fact that your balance is paid change, but you haven't had the quantity adjustments. And then bang, you go up the top and you get to the top of the J and you finally benefit from that. Now that of course has worked a charm in Australia. Over 40 years, the trade deficit, barely even changed.
Yeah.
It went, we'd get bigger. We had him, Paul Keating, first of all, talking about Australia becoming a banana republic when the trade deficit was 6% of GDP. It now has finally hit about roughly around zero and slightly positive. But not at all with the alacrity that was assumed by the theory. And of course, you look at countries like Japan, which has been running trade surpluses pretty much indefinitely since the late 1970s, and only had a couple of disturbances in its surpluses due to the oil crisis in 73 and 79. So the whole idea that the price system will get rid of these imbalances is just poppycock.
Yeah, well,
that's probably a better word than...
Yeah, okay. We're unsafer territory. Of course, in Australia, it's driven even more, of course, because Australia's balance of trade seems to be almost entirely driven by the price of iron ore. You know, it's either good or bad.
Yeah, which it comes down to a couple of commodities. Because they're a commodity exporting nation, then the price of the commodity determines whether they have a boom or a bust on the balance of payments.
So do you think...
But overall...
Yeah. Do you think anyone gets it then in government anywhere in the world? So we look at... Because Rishi Sunak, for example, has changed in tune. In 2017, he was saying FDI, foreign direct investment, creates real jobs. Some 70,000 last year alone, of which 70% were outside London, he said. He said FDI raises productivity with new management practices, drives innovation, which fuels our future prosperity. Then...
He didn't work in merchant banking at some point,
did he? He might have done,
Since
he's become treasurer, last October, he was saying, we've actually got to keep our eyes wide open to foreign investment because of the risk of intellectual property theft by hostile countries. Like, I'm not quite sure what those countries would be, like the USA.
Maybe Russia.
Yeah, or the USA, which are actually the biggest investor in the UK.
Oh, no, they're friendly.
I know. Yeah. So
warm and cuddly. Look what they're doing to Meghan and Harry. Warm and cuddly.
I don't know. So he's completely turned around his thinking, and he's talking about hostile countries rather than companies, because you can't have hostile companies. But in reality, that's what happens, isn't it? I mean, companies come in, take over other companies. He seems to have suddenly clicked on to actually that one might be what foreign direct investment means.
Yeah, because it only gets the technological hit they're talking about. If the foreign direct investment ends up with new technology which improves what you're doing. So a large part of, like for China, for example, China made a killing out of getting American companies to come in from offshore, but it was literally coming in from offshore and establishing a new company and bringing their technology with them. The whole objective was to get hold of that technology and also to create a local capitalist class, which they did. When you're looking at the type of foreign direct investment, let's use another Australian example. I wonder how many of our listeners can tolerate Vegemite.
If they can eat Marmite.
Not you? Marmite man, are you?
Neither, actually, unless they are spread very thinly and disguised by other things on top.
I use layers of... when people see me putting Vegemite on a sandwich, I think I'm putting down mortar for the Great Wall of China. the Vegemite was bought out by Kraft, I think. So Vegemite was a quintessentially Australian company. Those who don't know it, it's a yeast extract from making beer, had a high vitamin B content, and it was made into a saleable product in Australia where it's far stronger than Marmite. And became a sort of, you know, one of those things Aussie kids got to eat. Then it was all, you know, local technology that developed. It turned a waste product into a retail product, doing very nicely. And then, I'm not quite certain when it was, but about something 10 or 20 years ago, it was bought by Kraft.
Yeah.
And then what actually happened, there was no change in the technology, no improvement in that sense. But what it meant, the profits from selling Vegemite went overseas.
Yeah,
and that's what's forgotten about when you have financial capital taking over your industrial capital. What then happens is profits that used to be retained onshore and might be invested onshore. Certainly, the decision about whether the investment will happen or not would be taken by your country's nationals. Now that decision is made by a different country, and it may be the profits just go overseas and help develop the company that bought the product rather than helping develop the country in which the product was.
So it only really works when foreign money is being put in to start a company to create something that wasn't there before. If it's replacing something, and then it's, as you say, it's just, even if they are providing technological innovation, is that technological innovation enough to compensate for the fact that all the profits are going overseas? But I mean, what you described in Australia is happening all over the place in the UK. So Cadbury's is American. You know, all these British brands, Rolls-Royce is German, Dulux is Dutch, Harvey Nichols is owned by a Hong Kong company. Kit Kat is Swiss. The Financial Times is Japanese. The House of Fraser is Chinese. Manchester United Football Club is owned by an American. Where does it end?
Well, it doesn't if it keeps on going, because this is my perspective on letting foreign direct investment take over that much of your industrial base. You end up being a country of workers with no capitalists. Not to say there's not wealthy people ashore making money out of the whole process, but you no longer have a local capitalist class innovating. All the decisions are being made and the offshore owners. And this to me can end up meaning that your country grows more slowly than if it hung onto the capital itself, or it balanced its current account and capital account books by selling bonds rather than by selling going concerns.
Mm. So up to the Brexit decision, foreign direct investment actually had been falling. We had there was 200 billion in 2016, which fell to 66 billion in 2018 and down to 36 billion in 2019, and a massive drop from 200 to 36. Mm. But then, as I said in the introduction, it's all turned around again. Now, you know, we're back into the hundreds of billions. And I can only assume that is because we know now that there's no tariffs into Europe. So foreign companies are buying their way into the UK as their way of still getting into Europe. And in that scenario, then we are we're getting foreign investment into companies that are exporting. But as you say, also the profits are going to be exported. So, you know, we might have a few jobs, but you'd assume automation is going to be a large part of this. You can understand why, to try and take a slice of the pie, perhaps Rishi Sunak's looking at that and saying, OK, well, the only thing we can do in that case is push up our corporate tax. So at least we clip the ticket.
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, there's no, you know, the capacity of companies to evade taxation is obviously legendary.
Yeah,
just shift and your profits. You don't need it to finance your government spending anyway. The real thing you should be doing, I mean, this is where I differ with MMT, is that I think you should be trying to run a trade surplus, at least aiming for a trade balance, if not a trade surplus, because that gives you investable funds you don't otherwise have. And a large part of what's, you know, financing, you mentioned Japan, China, Germany, et cetera, these are countries running trade surpluses. Mm. And the companies that are doing that are building up reserves from international currency reserves in their own, or they're forcing their own central bank to create, you know, euro in return for the surplus dollars they bring in from their trade with America. But the end result is you've got an investable funds turning up. And it may well be that you get a better return by using that to buy foreign companies rather than investing domestically. So you get I think the classic would be the extent to which the privatized British Rail is owned by the
Hong Kong
government rail corporations of the continent.
Mm. Well, yeah. I'm talking about that on my my other podcast this week about the structure of rail in the UK. So, yeah, I mm-hmm. do another podcast, you know, every day, by the way. It's thebusiness.co.uk, mm-hmm. just in case you haven't been there yet. But is it really a positive balance of trade? Is it really a trade surplus if the trade surplus is created by companies in your country exporting overseas, but the company itself is owned by a foreign entity? Is that really a positive balance of trade? It would be on the books, wouldn't it? But
it's on the books, but it just shows the extent to which the way economists think about the boundaries and the global economy isn't the way the boundaries actually exist, because transnational corporations, as they were once called, multinational companies, they have operations in numerous countries, and the profits in one country can be returns to people in another. And one essential thing about the model of free trade, which is so beholden of mainstream economists, is they assume perfect mobility, of capital and labor inside a country and perfect immobility between countries. Now, the perfect mobility in a country is because they've got to say, you know, you allocate your capital efficiently, or your labor and capital instantly move to the right place pointed to by price signals. But the reason for saying no mobility whatsoever, which of course is a complete contradiction of reality, the reason for saying that is that if you don't pretend that all profits in England are accrued to English capitalists and all wages to English workers, if you don't make that false assumption, then you can't prove that free trade is going to benefit everybody in that society, because the returns to capital if there's a change in the price structure that favours capital over labour, those returns to capital in the UK could accrue to capitalists in America or China or Japan or Germany, and you don't get that guaranteed welfare benefit out of free trade. So they simply assume that the real world doesn't exist, which, of course, makes things a lot easier.
So I've seen the IMF refer to where you've got those investments which are made, but it's really passed on to somewhere else. In other words, you know, it's foreign companies owning and then repatriating the profits. They call it, so there's no real benefit to the local economy. They call them phantom FDIs. So
that's a good one.
Luxembourg is an example of that. Its inward FDI is about the same as the United States, but it's all transitory because their outward FDI is about the same as their inward FDI. So, I mean, that just says, okay, here's an economy.
I hear it's a nice place to do your laundry.
Well, exactly. Well, there it is. A lot of it, apparently, queuing up in and out. But, I mean, profitable and just charitable, I should say, and just say it's the finance industry. And that is what, you know, obviously the government is hoping here. They seem keen to boost the globalization of the City of London, attract new companies from overseas to invest here. But really what they're talking about when they say invest here, I mean, they're not even necessarily saying, are they, buy up a UK company. They're actually just saying, well, we want you to list here, list in Britain. And that might count as more foreign investments too, but the companies aren't necessarily even located here. So is that good or bad or indifferent for the UK economy? I guess it creates a few extra jobs in the cities to try and replace those we've lost through Brexit, but really it's no material benefit, is it?
No, it's no material benefit, and it's a form of de-industrialization as well. When the way foreign direct investment is sold, it helps you industrialize. And there are examples of that. I mean, China, I think, is the classic case where foreign direct investment caused obvious massive industrialization. But in general, when this is done under the steam of multinational corporations between countries of similar levels of development, it ends up being a way of scraping off the profit or getting rid of competitors and moving into buying a market position rather than necessarily bringing a new product to that market.
So Britain investing overseas would obviously be a good thing if we were buying up companies overseas or helping to grow businesses overseas, because that would see those profits repatriated back here. But to do that, I guess we've got to have the companies. We're going to have the want to expand. We're going to have companies that are successful here that want to expand and take over companies in their line of work elsewhere. And I'm not so sure there's too many of those.
Well, then you got a few British examples. I mean, the vacuum Dyson company.
Well, he's moved overseas.
But that's now based in Singapore, isn't it?
Yeah, based in Singapore. Yeah. Well, I think it's a part of it's here, but most of the labor is done in Singapore. Yeah.
What you can certainly say is that, is like in terms of the UK's position, it's gone from one of the significant industrialised countries to an also-ran over the last 30 years, or certainly the last 25 years. And a lot of that has been driven by, a free market approach, which basically said, let's ignore, this has been coming from Maggie Thatcher, let's make us into a service exporter rather than a manufacturing country. And that idea was the services are going to fill the void left by the collapse in the export market of manufacturers. But in fact, that hasn't happened. You've continued running a trade deficit, and manufacturing has gone from 20% of the economy to 10%. One of the countries you mentioned that's taking over British industries, this country called Germany. I believe they've tried it a couple of times before.
So they're much more successful this time.
Don't mention the war.
Slight change of tack. Exactly.
That still has 20% of its GDP being from manufacturing. So to me, this whole idea that you can service sector your way out of trouble just doesn't realize that, yes, services are a major part of the economy, but when you leave banking out of it, it's services like haircuts, health and so on, which are not particularly exportable, and you end up spending less on them than you spend on the manufacturers. And if you run your manufacturing sector down, you get a trade deficit and you get caught in a bit of a vicious cycle, which is where I think the UK is headed.
Yeah. So if we were to try and turn that around, I guess if you had foreign companies investing money into this country to expand into this market and maybe to expand into Europe, like building cars here, for example, if they were able to provide some sort of innovation and perhaps use a bit of local expertise, I mean, it's not great, but it's a step in the right direction, isn't it? Because we can build on that expertise, and there's got to be some hope there. And obviously, it's creating employment that didn't exist before. So that sort of, if it's expanding an existing entity, there is a benefit from that. Better than nothing at all, anyway.
Well, this is, I mean, that's one reason where you could regard the investment, hate me bringing in Elon Musk here, but Musk's building a gigafactory in Germany. You can perceive it that way. I mean, yes, they're bringing a technology. He's actually not buying the German equivalent of Vegemite. What would that be? Sauerkraut? Mm. He's not buying sauerkraut and selling it back to Germans. He's building a brand new factory with advanced technology, which has only been developed not just in America, but in his company. And there's also talk of a partnership with VW. So that is a case where, yes, you are getting quite unique overseas technology as part of foreign direct investment. And that's the poster child of that sort of behavior. But most of this stuff tends to be buying existing capital stock and taking over the ownership without actually changing the manner of production or improving the technology at all.
So the FDI definition by the Office of National Statistics is where FDI is where the parent company controls at least 10% of the voting power of the company being invested in. So they can't. So if you just built factories here, if you were a German company and you just decided you're going to build factories here, then that actually wouldn't be counted as FDI by that definition, because you actually have to have bought into a company based here. So FDI, by that measure, basically is corporate takeovers, isn't it? It's not somebody expanding into this country and employing people. That wouldn't be counted as investment.
If that's so, how do they actually classify a case of, you know, where a brand new firm is built and a factory constructed? Is that covered in the stats? It must be covered in the stats.
Well, they say no. The FDI is where the parent company controls at least 10% of the voting power of the company being invested in this country. So,
well, I mean, if you have a company setting up a foreign owned extension of itself, then it'll be 100% ownership. So it would still fall in there. What you're missing is any definition in terms of the physical capital. It's all about the financial capital.
Yeah. And that's the problem, isn't it? It is all. Mm. And that, so, I mean, how should we measure it then?
Well, I mean, I would actually like to divide it into when it is just simply a financial issue where you're taking over ownership of shares and doing nothing to the productive base, and versus ones where you are actually bringing in some technology, and preferably technology you don't have domestically, so you actually get the sort of benefit you're talking about for it. Now, I think you probably find that 90% plus of the investment is the former case, buying into the ownership structure. Very little of it would be bringing in foreign technology. The example of, I mean, I can't think of an equivalent example of Tesla to Germany in the UK. There may be some, but most of the time, this stuff doesn't bring any new technology with it. It simply changes the ownership of the firm.
Yeah. So every time the pound drops significantly, well, it's a little bit different in these days, but normally when there's not a pandemic going on, if you see the pound drop, the FTSE 100 normally increases. And that's because we do, you know, there are a lot of the FTSE 100 companies are actually companies that own so many businesses overseas, or they're operating overseas and listed on the FTSE 100, that the ability to repatriate those profits with a lower pound helps those businesses on the stock exchange. So there's evidence, isn't it, of you know, where your business is and what exchange rates are, and how complicated that becomes when you're looking at investments overseas.
Yeah, I mean it's one of these things which is sold on the poster basis. You know, the brand new factory in Germany example, but the reality is far more frequently the financial. So, like, again, with the stock market is sold as a place which actually raises capital. In fact, the amount of new capital raised on the stock market is pitiful compared to the amount of takeover money involved and changing ownership of existing shares. So the secondary market far dominates the primary, but the whole process is sold on the basis of what the primary market does. And on that basis, I'd like to see these things, including, effectively a primary market test. Is this improving UK technology, for example. If you let a foreign company invest in one of your domestics, is there a technology quid pro quo as well as a quid pro dollar?
So there's a new share. I mean, they're trying. I mean, sadly, the whole focus for this government seems to be, no, we just need to get more investment. It means selling more shares, irrespective of how that works out, even to the point of saying, well, okay, let's find vehicles now where companies can basically raise capital through listing on the share market, even though they don't actually produce anything. And then they can go out and use that money as shopping money to go and try and buy other companies. Which would almost certainly be overseas because there's not too many companies to buy here. So again, it's just transiting through London. It's just another way, isn't it, of getting more listings on the London Stock Exchange.
Yeah, and the whole city is, you know, the whole country is dominated by the city. I mean, you know, that's one thing you have to live in the UK for a while to really experience that. But the wealth gap between the city and London itself and then between London and the rest of the country is huge. And because the politicians... the financial sector has the ear of the politicians in a way that the industrial sector lost long ago and the workers haven't had since the days of Macmillan. You get policies which support the financial sector coming out. They try to dress them up as though they support the entire country, but it's a bit of a sham.
So China, of course, says if you're going to invest in our country, then you've got to have a local partner. You know, it's got to be a 50-50 operation.
That was the classic thing with the Chinese. I don't know if they still do it, but I mean, that was that I heard literally from the horse's mouth, or for the otherwise known as the management of the Shenzhen Free Trade Zone in 1982. If you're going to invest in an American company in the Shenzhen Free Trade Zone, which is China's first free trade zone, you had to have a Chinese partner. Hmm. They had to own 50% of the business within 5 years, even though they started with zero contribution to the capital. So the Chinese were very deliberate, saying, okay, yes, we want your money and we want your technology and you've got to give some of the ownership to us. And if I wanted to compare industrial policies, I think I'd have more time for China's than I have for the UK.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, maybe it's not quite as enticing, is it, when there's only a market of 65 million people? But I mean, would Britain be in the position to say such a thing here? Look, if you're going to invest in this country, you've got to have a partner.
No, because again, in the initial days, it wasn't a case of taking advantage of the Chinese market because there was none. Mm. I had some vivid memories of going through China.
Yeah.
Pardon?
It was just the cheap labor force.
Cheap labor force, that's right. Yeah. Now, the UK is getting there.
That's right.
With shithouse wages. My third swear in one show. You might actually get to the stage where you're the cheap wage enclave off the coast of Europe. But that's not exactly an ambition you should have. You try to be more the island of Singapore than God knows what the other island would be. But, cheap way, making yourself into a second Romania is not to me a particularly sensible way to go when you began with a good industrial structure.
Right. So is it fair to say then that more foreign direct investment almost certainly is a bad thing for the UK?
I have that attitude. I mean, I know there are going to be exceptions, but I'd be looking for the exceptions rather than the rule when it comes to applications to invest money in a national economy. You've got to say, okay, you expect it to mean your ownership is going overseas. You'll lose a certain amount of control. It better be a good offset for that. And the offset isn't just the fact that you pay the current shareholders a nice, tidy sum of money.
But could you also say, well, okay, yeah, there does need to be some control happening here as well. I mean, then you get back to that 50% rule. I mean, to actually be able to say, well, no, you can't move or you can't close this plant that you've built up because the board's not going to allow it because there's too many Brits on board. Then you get into that 50% rule that China had, and that's not going to wash, is it, as you say?
Yeah.
So you've really got to make sure the rules are right at the beginning. So it needs to be stipulated, doesn't it? There's got to be some benefit. If you're going to put money into, this, so what are we saying? If you're going to put money into this country, then you've got to show that it's going to create certain benefits for this country. But then that would go against this idea that, no, we just want people to list on the London Stock Exchange. We don't really care. Because that's going to create a few jobs. I don't know, where do you draw the line?
Well, I think it'd be drawn a long way from where it's currently being drawn. The line at the moment is around the City of London, and everything good has to happen inside the line. This is why the UK has been deindustrialized. Remember, as a kid, one of my favorite shows was called The Plane Makers. Did you ever see it?
No, you are talking before my time.
Okay, well, yeah. It was about a British company involved in the manufacture of planes. Now, that at the time was not a preposterous comedy theme. Okay, mm-hmm. It would be now. There must be some UK manufacturers of some aircraft, I imagine. But
Rolls-Royce engines. I mean, the days when they were hanging off the wings of most planes.
Who was Rolls-Royce?
So the Germans own them, I think, don't they? Yeah, yeah, I know, exactly.
But the wheels have just fallen off your Messerschmitt.
No, no, exactly. That's right, but the engine's still there.
That's fair enough.
So, okay. So I'm wondering where we go with this. How do you implement it in a way which is effective? I mean, how do you ensure that the investment? Because you can't. Surely you can have both. Surely you can say, well, okay, we want the city to prosper because we need to sell those luxury cars, and someone's got to buy those expensive houses in London. So let's have that. How do you allow that to happen while at the same time saying, but we also, as well as people just investing in this country because they just want to be listed on the London Stock Exchange, how do you also say, but we need to make sure that there's a good growth in the industrial base, and we'll be happy to take money and expertise from overseas to ensure that that happens?
Well, that's where you start looking at where the holes are in your industrial structure to begin with and where you need to fill them. And that's where, again, I come back to my admiration for the I think there are two databases called the Global Index of Complexity.
Complexity.
Harvard and one of the other American universities. And they simply say there are, you can see which industries are necessary to support other industries and what new industries can be generated by combining existing industries. And those are the ones you encourage investment in, both domestic and international. If you can't get the domestic, then you go for the international. But something like that that has a look at the overall industrial structure and what you wish to change. And of course, that's going to get much more serious, I think, in the aftermath, not just of COVID, but also with climate change coming our way. We could see the end of the days of long global supply chains.
So do we say, okay, if you're not in those industries, you can't? Or do we say, no, we'll give you some sort of incentive. We'll give you a tax break, or as we said, don't normally have much influence because people can shift around profit centers as they feel fit. But you give some sort of incentive. I don't know, maybe you give them lower rates, for example, industries.
Your question whether you want to encourage the thing in the first place, but I'd certainly say if you're going to encourage foreign direct investment, make sure it's something that builds your industrial structure. Yeah. If it doesn't, then don't go looking for it.
All right, that's fair enough. We'll leave it there. Great to talk again, Steve. Catch you next week.
Okay, yep.
And another absolute corker next week. We're going to look at the economics of how firms work, the idea of the supply and demand curves. And look, you know what conventional economists tell you is the way it works and how it works in reality. That's next time on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Back next week. See you then.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.